Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to super attorney Steve Yared, who organized a massive book of color photographs and inspirational quotations about his other lifelong passion, the New York Yankees. Stick around. The score is tied, the bases are loaded, Yared's at bat, and I expect the umpire will hear one hell of a closing argument. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archives, celebrity, and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by Audible. Audible is offering Mr. Media listeners a free audiobook download and a 14-day trial offer to give you a chance to check out their very cool service. I love listening to books on tape. If you've never tried it before, actors or sometimes the authors themselves read to you. It's great for the commute, the beach, or even unwinding before bed. You can choose a free audiobook from Audible's enormous library of best-selling titles, including The Help by Catherine Stockett, A Stolen Life by J.C. Dugard, and Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. Here's an excerpt from Bossy Pants, read by the author, Tina Fey.
Because I am nothing if not an amazing businesswoman, I researched what kind of content makes for best-selling books. It turns out the answer is one-night stands, drug addictions, and recipes. Here, we are out of luck. But I can offer you lurid tales of anxiety and cowardice. Why is this audiobook called Bossy Pants? One, because the name Two and a Half Men was already taken. And two, because ever since I became an executive producer of 30 Rock, people have asked me, is it hard for you being the boss? And is it uncomfortable for you to be the person in charge? You know, in that same way they say, gosh, Mr. Trump, is it awkward for you to be the boss of all these people? I can't answer for Mr. Trump, but in my case, it is not.
You can also download The Profiler, written by famed criminal profiler Pat Brown and yours truly, which Pat will read to you personally. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of ambulance chasers who may dream Steve Yared-sized dreams, but they'll never match his championship heart. In the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Like, the New York Yankees really needed any more books extolling their virtues. Really, Steve Yared? Really? Now, if you want heart, try winning the American League East with a Tampa Bay-sized budget. Oh, that's right. The Tampa Bay Rays did that for two of the last 3 years. Okay, all right. Look, I got that out of off my chest. It's out of the way. I think from this point forward, I can be a very fair host. I have to be. Tampa Super Attorney Steve Yared. You can see him on your screen. You can hear him. He's one of the lead lawyers when Florida won a court judgment of something like $11 billion from tobacco companies. He put together a pretty remarkable coffee table book called "The Making of a Championship Heart: Lessons Learned from Baseball and Life." Yared, who called the late George Steinbrenner a personal friend for 3 decades, used his unique access to his favorite team to interview current and past players in search of the secret to their inspiration. He then cleverly combined their words of wisdom with color and black and white images of them in action. Now, whether you're a fan of the damn Yankees, I apparently am not, or just interested in better understanding what motivates a winner, there's a lot to like in the making of a championship heart. And it doesn't hurt that Yared is pledging a portion of the proceeds from sale of the books to pediatric cancer charities. Steve Yared, welcome to Mr. Media.
How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, Bob, I'm good. Prior to your introduction, I was even better.
You know, somebody who didn't live in the Tampa Bay area, I wouldn't have given him such a hard time for being such a huge Yankee fan, but... You know, I got to take a shot where I can. Let's face it. Once I turn your mic on and you could start talking, I'm not going to win any more arguments.
Well, actually, you know, I have season tickets. I sit behind home plate at the Rays games, and I must confess I still have season tickets in Yankee Stadium for the Yankees, and I'm blessed to be able to attend both. It's a very difficult time when they play each other. But, you know, Bob, one of the things about the book, I picked the Yankees not because I'm a fan of the Yankees. I am. But it could have been about any team or any person, actually, that possesses what I've found to be the components of a championship life. And the reason that the Yankees were such a natural for me is my relationship with George obviously helped. And secondly, they have almost a century of the winning traditions. And, you know, after a certain period of time, a question I've always asked myself in a courtroom, why do people consistently win? What is it in the boardroom that consistently make people like Warren Buffett a winner, you know, or someone in the media? Why are they always successful in getting recognized as being the best? Mm-hmm. And I found that there were 18 components of that. And one of the things the Yankees exemplified was a championship tradition. And, you know, those don't come by luck. They don't come by a happenstance. They come by a combination of these components. And that could easily be the Rays we're describing if they have a history of winning. I don't think it's going to be a history of 2 or 3 years, however. Mm.
Well, but I got to, in fairness, I teased a little bit in the introduction, but I mean, I'll give you an example. Years ago, I did a book with a billionaire Wall Street guy. And I won't name names here, but I helped him with his book. And afterwards, several people made the same comment. When he wrote his book about how to become rich like he is, did he say that you start with $1 million and then you build from there? And, yeah. And I mean, in the case of the Yankees, you would almost have to have a chapter dedicated to, okay, if you have the richest revenues in the land, you can build pretty much anything you want. You can have that money.
Yeah, no question about that. As a matter of fact, that's one of my criticisms of the legal system. You know, too often the winner in the courtroom is not the person that's got the just cause or the right cause. It's the person that's or the entity that's the most money. You know, the person that can hire the best attorneys. And that's what our wonderful legal system does provide. It provides an opportunity where, and I don't like the David versus Goliath, but it does provide, you know, what our forefathers envisioned. Some of the time, not all the time, certainly not as many times as I'd like, and that's equal justice under law. Go back to what you've said. It's true. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The most moneyed teams are highly more competitive than those less moneyed. I mean, you can almost buy, I hate to say it, almost buy a ring, a championship. What the book describes, however, goes to the common person, whether they're a billionaire or the poorest person in the land, we only have a certain amount of time on this planet. And I don't define winning by how many toys you have or how many rings you've got or how many trophies you get. What I define winning to be is that life has been lived rather than the passage of a lifetime endured. And that means doing good. Making the best of his or her life defines to me a champion. And I think, for example, what inspired me much more than the Yankees, are the pediatric cancer kids I work with. Mm-hmm. Here are kids that are cursed with a deadly disease. Their whole family's affected. And yet in these little warriors, I see all the components of a champion. And they're never going to get a ring. Mm-hmm. Doubt if they're ever going to be recognized as world champions. But every year, we have events, my foundation, we have events, and one of the events is a fishing derby, for example. And we try to decide, well, how do these kids compete and win a fishing derby? At the end of the day, you know what we decided? We gave out 110 gold medals because every single person that was there that day that participated, whether they came from the cancer wards or they came from their family homes through the remission that God and medical community has been able to provide them, they were all champions. And that's what captures the essence of the book. If I did nothing more than do that, capture what these little kids have inside their chest, oh, then it's a winner. And whether it sells or not is of no consequence to me.
Now, you talked in the introduction about doing a lot of interviews for the book and talking and sitting down with a lot of people. Can you tell us about some of the people you interviewed and some of the more memorable conversations you had for this?
Oh, I've got to tell you, talking to Don Larson in New York, a perfect game, the only perfect game pitched in World Series history, talking to him with his wife coming in and out of the room, it was supposed to be 15 minutes, it was a couple of hours.
a person that's not in the book I spent 2.5 hours with was Ted Williams. I mean, he was a Red Sox player of wonderful fame. And they're right, it's amazing. He could have put on a Yankee uniform and fit right in because he had that championship heart. And did he have flaws? Oh, who doesn't? But Don Larson, let's go back. Don Larson was a Yankee interviewed. He made a tremendous impression on me because of his humility. He didn't even realize he pitched a perfect game until he went in the dugout. Someone said, oh, you really pitched great today, Don. You no-hit him. And somebody said, no-hit him. He pitched a perfect game. To which Casey Stengel replied, Larson, you were pretty good today. And he said, Casey, Skipper, how in the hell could I have been better? I was perfect. He said maybe that was the only time in his life he was perfect. Mm. And his wife chimed in about that time. She said, no, Don, it's not. That to me, you know, that defined a great interview because he looked at a perfect game as the only time he'd been perfect. And his wife, who loved him more than anything in the world, been with him for years and years and years, looked at him and said, no, Don, that's not the only time you've been perfect. So, you know, talking with Reggie Jackson, I mean, his ego, I mean, we all know about Reggie Jackson, Mr. October's ego.
It's the straw that stirs the drink.
When I started talking about the kids, you know, when I started to, the straw left and the real heart came out. And he talked about spirituality, talked about giving these kids some motivation and some hope. You know, the person that rocked my world the most probably in the interviews was, because I talked to him so many times, was George. I mean, George had a unique way of being bold, hard, if you will, certainly powerful. But he had a kind, gentle way about him when the right message was delivered to him, like, hey, boss, you want to make a difference? He invariably answered the bell, and he always did it the right way with me. Oh, yeah, Steve, I'll do that, but I want no mention. I want it anonymous. Mm-hmm. And that told me volumes about why he was doing it. Because, you know, people that want the credit and want their name on the book building, maybe they were doing it for the right reasons, and I applaud them. But, you know, it's not always putting a name out there that matters. It's kind of what we do. So you asked me, I loved Johnny Damon. You talk about a great guy. Johnny Damon was wonderful to interview. You know why? Because he's like a kid in a baseball uniform that's in a man body. I mean, right. He loves playing the game. And you know what he talked about? He talked about not only how much he loved playing the game, but what he was able to do for his parents when he made it. After all they'd done for him, that impressed me. Mm-hmm. Tino Martinez, good friend of mine. Again, going back to what he was able to do for his family, how he simply, Jorge Posada, admitted very upfront, hey, look, I wasn't the best player. I wasn't close to the best catcher. He said, but nobody ever outworked me. Mm. Wade Boggs, who's a very dear and close personal friend of mine, I do a lot of things with Wade that have nothing to do with baseball and have a lot to do with charity. Wade's my co-host at the Celebrity Grand Slam Tournament we do every year here. We've done cystic fibrosis work together. We've lit baseball fields for schools that had eye injuries because of the dark spots. But, I mean, he's just an all-around great guy. I mean, not to mention he's a Hall of Famer, you know, which is kind of a unique thing. I think there's, 60 of them alive now, 57 of them alive. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of in a small universe of stars. But his interview, I mean, all those people gave me insights. But what I'll tell you, Bob, is something amazing. All the interviews, if you just took out the names, almost sounded the same. I mean, it's almost like talking to the same person. Well, what is important to you? Well, you know, preparation, hard work, perseverance, determination, integrity, respect, giving back, teamwork. I mean, those, and invariably, what is the last one? And the most important, heart. Mm. Oh, you know, the difference is when everything else tells you to quit, you keep going. Heart. Yogi Berra talking about heart. He wasn't inarticulate when he talked about that. I mean, his interview was right on the money.
I wanted to ask you about George. He did have this reputation. I think his reputation in the Tampa Bay area, where you and I are, is probably very different than his reputation in New York. New York, because of the media and just the way he was seen as pretty much one way. He was the boss. He was the screaming, yelling, sometimes arrogant, sometimes obnoxious. guy who ran the Yankees for 3 decades, or maybe it's 4 decades. I've actually kind of lost track. But here in Tampa, he had this very different reputation. He was this guy who was known to be kind of a soft touch, quietly and privately, for charities or individual cases of people who were in need that he would hear about. You got to know him, obviously, very well over 30 years. How did he balance those two personalities? It seems so different.
I think Bob, that's a great question, because isn't that the essence of life? I mean, the essence of life. Look, in the courtroom, I'm known not to take prisoners. I mean, that's the way I play as hard as I can, and I give it everything I've got, because I've got usually a family depending on me to right or wrong, and there's a lot of pressure. So if I do anything less than my best, friendship is not a game that I can play in a courtroom. You know, we can be friends after. I don't put my arm around the opposing white legal team. There's usually more than one, quite a few more than one, and say, hey, well, you know, let's have a drink after court today. I don't do that. Mm-hmm. In terms of balancing, I see a lot of people that are successful, hard driving, tough, just excuse my language, but hard ass people. But are they successful in life? No, because the domineering aspect of George's life that you talked about, that was so well known in the New York area, did not change in the sense that he was, and I know you said it in a nice way, a soft touch. He was dominating and the boss when it came to charity too, because he saw things that were wrong and he said, hey, get your butt off the sideline. We got to get this thing fixed. These kids need help, or this hospital's got to be built, or this school's got to be done, or, you know, a whole laundry list of things. And the point being, he took those leadership skills into the area of philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And with those same leadership skills that everybody feared on the one hand, they admired and loved on the other, because sometimes we forget. It's not the checkbook. It's not the amount of money you have. You are as rich as any other man, as am I, with regard to the amount of time we have. And when we give our time, that truly is a treasure that we're all equal in. You know, nobody, being a rich man doesn't give you a bigger, longer life. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think that probably shortens your life. My experience is that there's a lot of worries that come with a lot of success. But if there's a key to that, in terms of offsetting the negative, which you mentioned in the New York market, with a positive, which you mentioned in the Tampa Bay market, it's the key that George and many others, and I've been blessed to find it out early on, the key that we've all found to work and unlocked the secret, at least to my life and success, and that is giving back. You know, no matter how much I ever got or how much I ever gave myself, and then believe me when I tell you, my mother worked very hard, but we came from very poor, very, very humble backgrounds. My mother supported me on $300 a month, and I paid my way. I had 2 jobs in law school at Georgetown, and it was tough. Mm-hmm. But I'm not complaining. Look, I don't have that life anymore. But none of that hard work, none of that, oh, now I've got a nice car, now I've got a nice house, oh, now I've got a nice boat or a plane or what, none of that made me feel near as good as when I give something to the people that really need it. And I know for 1 second on this planet, I've been able to make a positive difference. That's what George Steinbrenner did, but on a much grander scale. Unlike him, I've never done anything worth anything without the help of others. I failed a lot on my own, but George was one of those gifted, wonderful people who was able to succeed. And when I say on his own, I got to tell you, I've also found a little helper. You know, I happen to believe in God, so I don't know that I've ever been alone, but I think that all the good things that happen in life happen with the help of others, or happen with the help of a higher power, or happen because we've got goodness in us. And Bob, it's a wonderful occasion to be able to put the goodness and the ideas of goodness I've had and combine it with having a dialogue with people that speak the same language. It's like landing on a strange planet and finding that they, in fact, speak the same language that I find so many other good people to speak. These winners, these champions, they all are from the same breed of cat.
Well, let me ask you one more question. We'll take a break about George. Where were you when you heard that he had passed? And what was the first memory or anecdote that came back to your mind that struck you that you thought about
him? I was in my house. I saw it on the news, and the first memory that passed through my mind was, death comes to us all, but what a hell of a life he led. You know, we all die. That doesn't really shock me. It saddens me, obviously. From a selfish standpoint, I would love to spend another day with my mother and father, another hour, another minute. I just like to see them. So what I've got to embrace is the good that I can remember that they did. So I don't see George as 80 dead. I see George at the height of his career, much like I see so many other people. George was important to me, but, you know, I had wonderful heroes in my life. I had a mother who, I've got to tell you, made George, he paled compared to her in terms of my eyes of being a hero. I mean, she was it. And she gave me everything. She gave me a chance. And my father and I reunited before his death, and he taught me how to win. Probably had a little more of the rough side on him than my mom. My mom taught me how to win, but she taught me how to give. So I love both of them. Right. And they were heroes. Answer your question long-winded lawyer fashion. I was saddened by George's passing, but what a wonderful, wonderful life he led.
Very good.
Made us all a little better.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with Tampa Super Attorney Steve Yared. You're welcome. His new book is The Making of a Championship Heart, Lessons Learned from Baseball and Life, and we'll be right back.
I'll be waiting.
Your donation to the American Red Cross can now help support the efforts of the Japanese Red Cross. In response to the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan, and given the widespread damage and enormous humanitarian needs, the Japanese Red Cross indicated that it would accept financial support from the American Red Cross for its role in providing first aid, emotional support, and relief items to those displaced. Those who want to help can go to www.redcross.org and donate to Japan Earthquake and Pacific Tsunami. People can also text Red Cross to 90999 to make a $10 donation to help those affected by this disaster. Your gift to the American Red Cross will support the disaster relief efforts to help those affected by the earthquake in Japan and the tsunami throughout the Pacific. Financial contributions to the American Red Cross are tax deductible. On those rare occasions when donations exceed American Red Cross expenses for a specific disaster, contributions are used to prepare for and serve victims of other disasters.
I'm saxophonist Mindy Abear, and you're listening to Mr. Media. Maybe watching, huh?
This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with Tampa Super Attorney Steve Yared, whose new book is The Making of a Championship Heart, Lessons Learned from Baseball and Life. And Steve, I was hoping in this segment we could talk a little bit about your other career, aside from, you know, producing books, being a lawyer. And what is it that attracted you to the field in the first place?
So much of the time we see things that are wrong in life, and at least I certainly always had this desire early on to try to right them. You know, I liked Don Quixote. I mean, I don't necessarily think life is full of tilting with windmills, but I do believe, you know, it's like the old the Jedi Knights in the Star Wars movie. Those types of roles always attracted me because maybe it's fantasy and maybe it's not. But boy, isn't it great to fight the dark side? I mean, I enjoy that. And I enjoy all the wonderful people I've been able to put into my life. And I am flattered by the trust that they give me. I'm honored by the causes they privilege me to represent. And most important, I guess, if I had to pick one thing in my career, I'm really, really appreciative of the changes we've been able to effectuate. You know, in tobacco, it wasn't just the multi-billions of dollars we got. That was great. But eliminating the pandering to children, Joe Camel, Marlboro Man, all the cigarette vending machines, all the things, the education about true nicotine addiction and the downside, all the things are going to make such a difference. And now almost seem taken for granted. I mean, we don't have smoking in restaurants. Mm-hmm. We don't have smoking on airplanes. I remember the first case I had against the banking industry. It was an ATM. It just came out. ATM case. The kid got his eye shot out. And I said, you know, they need lights and concrete instead of aesthetics and dim lighting. It doesn't matter how the hell it looks. How safe is it? And the bank industry said, well, no, that's the job of the police. It's an outside facility. That's what the police do. Well, we changed the way the world was with regard to bank machines because now they've taken responsibility. And security is important. And they even have video cameras and 911 buttons. I mean, but if you tell someone that the world wasn't like that, especially one of the younger people, they look at you like you got two heads. I mean, you're talking to a guy. I remember when the fax machine first came in, I said, you know, this is going to change the way we do business and the way we live, where there's not going to be any more go home for the day evenings. You know, it's going to be 24/7. I was so wrong. The fax machine was just a blip on the screen. Now we've got the internet and cell phones. Now we truly don't have any rest. I mean, there is no getting away. And if you don't take your cell phone on that deserted island, somebody looks at you like you got two hands.
Yeah,
that's the norm, not the exception.
Let me ask you something about the tobacco settlement. With several years, you know, you can Monday morning quarterback it quite a bit now. As you look back on it, does it look any – does the settlement and the way it was handled, particularly by the politicians, the money coming in afterward – is there anything you would have liked to have done differently in terms of structuring the money or anything about it that leaves you unhappy now?
Yes, there were things that occurred that were not disappointing. They were tragic. There were things that occurred to the American people, much like this debacle on the debt ceiling that just happened. I mean, when you look into that jar they call politics, it's a very distasteful, unpleasant sight. And what happened was we got the money. And then the politicians did their best to squander. I, in fact, had to sue the last two governors ago. I had to sue Governor Bush and everyone else up there in Tallahassee to get Florida to spend the money where they promised they would on student education, the youth movement. You know, you can't tell addicts to quit. That doesn't work. It's a non-starter. Addiction does not allow a choice. So what you do as a responsible government entity, and I'm not a big government, okay, but what you do is you give people the education, hey, don't do this or this will happen. If you do this, you will lose your ability to choose. Okay, that's much different than what occurred, which was they got the money almost like an entitlement program. The $400 to $500 million became a revenue, and they started squandering it like they squandered most of our tax dollars on their own little pet programs that had nothing, not a damn thing to do with the elderly, care of the youth, health programs, cancer research, all the things we got the money for. You know, and did all the politicians do that? No, not all, but too damn many of them. So what happened in Florida was I went to Congress and testified twice. What happened in Florida was all my efforts were unsuccessful, again, of course, and my lawsuit. They told me we promise we'll spend the money on the youth model programs, which, by the way, were the envy of the nation. Our programs were the envy of the nation. And we went from getting the second largest revenue in the country, okay, and spending in the top 10 on youth education to getting the second largest revenue in the country and being 47th among the 50 states in educating our youth and doing care programs. We laid off all the workers that worked on the Truth campaign. I mean, it went from $75 million to $1 million to basically zero. And as I said, I was unsuccessful, but the people of Florida rose up and we passed a constitutional amendment, which now requires the state of Florida to pay 10% of whatever they get in tobacco revenues, let's say $400 million. The state of Florida now has to pay $40 million for that youth education, for research on cancer and prevention of addiction to nicotine, et cetera. That, to me, is a wonderful accomplishment. And only the state of Florida has done that, by the way, passed a constitutional amendment. So did the politicians do that? No. Our people did that. So I don't give them much credit. They sure as hell didn't want us to sue the tobacco industry, the cigarette cartel. And we got a lot of flack. We almost lost. One vote kept us that lawsuit alive. But man, Bob, you should have seen their enthusiasm and support when we got them the money. We were their best friends. Yeah. We were the champions. In fact, somebody wanted to clean my stall, my white horse, you know, because I was such a hero. Come on, man. Come on. They wanted to crucify us. And then when we got back from the war, after we kicked tobacco's ass, you know what they did? The politicians told us the contract we had with the state of Florida, it was too much money. 25% of that huge amount was too much. We're not paying. So like some little you know, untrustworthy scoundrel you'd find on the street. They defied the contract, disavowed it, and dishonored it. You know what we had to do? We had to sue the state for our own fee. Luckily, what we ended up doing was we went back to tobacco. The cigarette company said, you know, I got a better idea. Instead of suing our state, we want you to pay our fees over and above what you paid the state of Florida. And guess what? We had enough gunslingers in our posse to get them to do that. So the $3 billion plus fee that we ultimately got, which we paid out over three decades to a lot of people, I wish I had gotten it all, right? But that money is coming directly from the cigarette cartel. So all these people that criticize these ambulance chasing lawyers, isn't that great? We got the state of Florida about $15 to $17 billion, and we charged them not one dime. But nobody knows that story. Anyway, that's one of the worst stories I can tell you about. I'm not obviously unemotional about that.
Well, I wanted to ask you one more question. I know we're just about out of time, but there was another big case that came up last year involving you in the state of Florida. Then Governor Crist asked for your help in going after BP.
Another sad story you're going to bring up too?
I'm sorry. Well, you have to come back on the show. We can talk about some happier stuff in more detail.
I'll do it. Here's that sad story. I saw a need. I saw a real need for the state of Florida to be represented at the table, have a seat at the table, because I saw a man-made disaster that should never have happened. It happened because the regulators were in bed with the people they were regulating. It happened because the folks we trusted weren't trustworthy. And then they basically went after what I love. You know, I'm sitting here feet from the Gulf of Mexico and Tampa Bay that I was raised on. And when they went after that, they went after my kids' legacy and my grandchildren's legacy. That was it. So Governor Crist asked me, and I was very, very honored, you know, to be special counsel to him regarding the entire oil spill disaster. I flew to Washington. I participated in the congressional hearings when the CEOs of those three wrongdoers, Halliburton, BP, and Transocean, were interrogated. We got very good answers. I thought we demonstrated wrongdoing for 7 months. I prepared about 1,000 hours worth of my time. I'm just talking about my time. About $100,000 of my money. I did it all for what's called pro bono. I did it for the good of the people. I can afford to do it. I thought it was the right thing to do. Like I said, it made me feel good. We had it all set up. And then Governor Scott was elected in November. So my term was ending December 31st, but obviously I'd done 7-8 months worth of hard work. Had a lot of jewels. I call them, you know, a treasure trove of an arsenal, if you will, to get the bad guys. Admitted bad guys. They weren't going to fight. It was like sticking a fork in a turkey that's been in the oven all day. It wasn't going to be a hard kill, right? Told them that I had done all this work, wrote them three letters, November, December, my term's ending December 31st. For a lot of reasons, I wasn't willing to go into a second area of time and certainly wasn't comfortable working with this administration. And that's for another day. But please let me know who I should transition this to. We don't want Florida's interest to fall between the cracks. Do you know, Bob, I never got the courtesy of a response. Not a phone call, oh my not God. A word. That's bad. That's but you know bad. What? I'm a big boy. I got thick skin, and I played in a lot rougher crowd than the crowd he runs with. But the real tragedy was all that work was never accessed. So what's going to happen? And I did an op-ed piece in the St. Pete Times and the Tampa Tribune about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Can easily be accessed. And I pointed out, when the day comes, I remember when Governor Scott got $30 million, he had his arm around the BP people, telling everybody what great people they were. These people ruined our ecology and did a couple of billion dollars worth of damage. Let me just say this. When the day comes, if it comes, that he ever gets any type of money, which we could sorely use. I mean, we needed that money yesterday. I mean, we're in a deficit spending. We're laying off government workers, cutting vital programs. You know, $2 billion would be a lot of money into the state coffers. We could do so much with that. And they owe us the money, okay? There'll be a day when he gets a couple hundred million dollars, he and the group he's got in Tallahassee, and they'll tout that as some big accomplishment. And on that day, I want you to pull up this interview and remember that Steve Yarad said they're getting 10 cents on the dollar. And you know what I call that? I call that chump change, Bob. Mm-hmm. Without calling anybody a chump, I would just say the result is chump change. It's like the Yankees going out and beating a Grapefruit League last seller place team and proclaiming themselves as world champions. I know what a world champion looks like.
Yeah.
I know what a world champion sounds like. And guess what? This ain't a world champion act we got going on with BP. And it's shameful. And I'm embarrassed. And I have to go elsewhere because I know a lot of people around the country. And then I have to explain to them why we haven't done anything. We're the lead dog. We're the lead state. And we're letting these people slide. Bah. So I'm not in politics. I wouldn't get elected. And I wouldn't run.
You and me both. Folks, listen, you can find Steve Yared's inspirational new book, The Making of a Championship Heart, Lessons Learned from Baseball and Life, at great bookstores everywhere. Or you can order it here right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. You can also learn more about the book at championshipheart.com.
Bobby, it's www.championshipheart.com. And one of the things I did, and it's not a sales pitch, but I really want to impress upon people, we're going to give that book and those proceeds back to the people that need it, back to the people that need hope, the Pediatric Cancer, Boys and Girls Club, a lot of child abuse organizations. You know, people that can use inspiration just need the book and the words. They could use some of the money. So, you know, I've been blessed. This wasn't a moneymaker for me, and it's been a wonderful gift in my life, and I'd like to gift it on. So everybody that buys it will know that they're helping a little bit. And, man, you know, that's a pretty good thing.
That's great. Well, Steve Yared, pleasure to talk to you. Fascinating story about the book and your career, and maybe we can get you to come back again sometime and talk a little more and some more.
My first interview on the internet, Bob, and you were it. So thank you very much, man.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us
today,
Mr. Media. All right. Bye-bye. For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And if you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. You can also download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. And, of course, you can always listen with a piece of string in a tin can in soap opera land. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line, 727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show, and unless you live next door to Mr. Media, it's probably a toll call. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube video channel. Thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Hey, folks. You can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it. It's free. Takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too, always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Guy Kawasaki. You're listening to Mr. Media, you poor slob.